Industry Council.
Get along. The Economic Development and Housing Budget Division will come to order for Monday, February 2nd, 2009. Today, we're just going to go through the governor's proposed budgets for the Historical Society, the Housing Finance Agency, and the Department of Commerce, and ask them to let us know what the effect of the proposal is on each of their divisions, and let anybody on the committee here ask any questions that they might have, and also ask if you have any different solutions than what's being proposed here, so that we can get going with our budget recommendations in the rest of this legislative session here. Ms. Archibald, welcome to the committee. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Senator. It's a pleasure to be here. Want to thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee today, and I'm sure we'll be having lots of conversations as the session unfolds. These are incredibly difficult days for Minnesota, for all Americans, and God knows we are certainly aware of it. But I guess before I even start, and we do not have today a definitive proposal to present to you about what exactly would happen if the governor's budget were to prevail, but we have some notion of what the impact certainly will
be. Do you want the governor's budget to prevail?
No, sir.
Oh, okay.
We prefer that the governor's budget did not prevail. But okay. I want to actually leave you with two messages.
She wants
I want to start with two messages, and I hope that these messages will be messages that I'll be able to convey to you throughout the session. One is that the Minnesota Historical Society is a team player, that we absolutely will do our part for Minnesota. We love Minnesota. This is our home. This is the story that we tell. It's a great place. We have done our part in years past. I just would remind the committee, those of you who have been around, and I know that there are some of you who were around in 2003, the Society's base budget at that time went from $27.3 million to $22.4 million. That was a major hit. When you look at how much of our program is directly tied to the appropriation. What we're able to deliver to the people of Minnesota is directly tied to the appropriation. In the interim, since fiscal year 2003, we have made some gains. So fiscal year 10, our base budget would have been $24.4 million. The governor's recommendation would push the society back to $21.76 million, which would be behind where we were at the end of the 2003 session. If you figure inflation into that and the rising cost of health care, you know that we are now in a very much backward position. Again, the service that we give to the people of Minnesota is directly proportional to the appropriation that we receive. I said I had two messages. One is about where we are, you know, what the situation is. But I also want to give a message of hope, because I think we all need, I certainly need, and I think everybody needs a message of hope. Work that we do, I think, helps people to understand where we are today, how we got to where we are today, and I think it does give them context so that they can go forward and think about what tomorrow might bring. I think what we offer to Minnesotans is educational, and it's highly entertaining. People enjoy coming to our programs and to seeing what we do.
Excuse me, Ms. Archibald, excuse me one second. Quorum is present. Okay, go ahead.
It has been affordable and as accessible as we can make it. I said that over my dead body there would be a fee on the History Center. My body is dead. We do have a fee on the History Center, and I regret that. And if I could bring a hope to this, all of this today, I would say that the Society in this time, when I think we have so much to offer to Minnesotans about where we are and what the future of Minnesota can be, I'd like to see us go from fees to free. And I know that probably can't happen, but there's nothing like hope to keep you going.
Can I ask you, I don't know if you're prepared with this right now, but you said in 2003 you went from 29 to 24.
In 2003 we went from 27.3 million base budget down to 22.4.
And then how did you handle that? Did you lay people off or
we laid
cut
people
services?
Off. We closed historic sites. We reduced hours. We put fees on the History Center. I don't know, David, can you recall how many positions we lost at that time? Oh, David Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. The impact on positions was somewhere around 75 positions.
And then did we hire them back? Because then the budget did go up, I think, in 2007, right?
We have had actually not much of an increase on the FTEs, but we've been able to increase the hours by just trying to be lots more efficient so that we've increased hours. We did get outside help to get us some historic sites open. The ones that were particularly threatened were Forestville and the Kelly Farm and the Hill House, yeah.
And so, the governor's recommendation for 10 is even less than what it was in 03.
If this happens, there's no question that there's going to be an impact on program. There's going to be, there will be layoffs, and there will be reduced services to people. There's no way to kid yourself that we can go on and do what we've always done with less dollars. We're going to make as good choices as we possibly can. The society's governing board is fully engaged with this. We have a strategic planning process underway, trying to set priorities for the institution, so we will do this in as sensible way as we can. But it is serious business, and it's serious for all of the agencies that come before you, I know. We can't have the same amount we've had for so little money to have with so much less here in Minnesota to deal with.
Okay, are you going to go through this?
I'll go through it very quickly, because one of the things we would like to do, Senator Tomasoni, is to leave time for questions, although I would tell you right now, having only had the governor's budget for, less than a week, we're not prepared to tell you specifically what we're going to do. But I know that there are many familiar faces around this table and people who know the Society's program well, but there are also some new people present, and so I think I should walk through it very quickly. I might mention on the other side of hope, a little bit of balance on the hope question, a little more to give us hope, is the legacy amendment. It frankly amazed me that the people of Minnesota would vote to increase their sales tax. I couldn't believe it when it happened in November. I was glad to see it happen because it means that we will take care of some of the things that we know have made our state special.
Do you think they knew what they were doing?
Excuse me,
do you think they knew what they were doing?
I don't know if they knew what they were doing. I think they did know what they were doing, as a matter of fact, because they voted for the things that matter to them. And I should mention that for the first time, the words Minnesota history are now included in the state's constitution. I know we're going to have an opportunity to talk with you later in the session about the amendment specifically, but I should tell you that the Society has been out. We have conducted meetings around the state to talk to our partner and sister organizations about what this could mean for history in our state, but more on that later. The Society has been around for 160 years. This is our 160th year. We're older than the state of Minnesota. I got to tell you, the record shows that we've seen it all, and I guess if I could leave you with another message of hope, it would be that Minnesota will ultimately prevail, and the Minnesota Historical Society will prevail. For whatever we have to go through, we will come out the other end. We're right now in the process of doing an exhibition that deals, and more than an exhibition, it's books, it's a big project, largely privately funded. Thank God we raised the money before all this hit. But we're opening an exhibition that deals with the Depression, the war years, and the subsequent boom. And I think that for Minnesotans to see that and have a sense of what people in the past have gone through, and then to see where that cycle has come out, will be really helpful. And so that project is underway. The exhibition will open on Memorial Day weekend of 2009. With all that as background, I'm going to just give you a very brief snapshot, because I know many of you are very familiar with the program. The Society was founded in 1849. We're the oldest educational institution in the state. In fact, we're the oldest institution in the state. So we've been around a while. We are guarded and guided by our territorial charters that, again, predate the state, one in 1849, and that was revised in 1856. We are governed, I mentioned our governing board. We have a citizen board, a 30-member governing board, which is elected by our members. And we carry out, we're an interesting organization, that we have this private nature, but we also carry out responsibilities under statute. There's a specific statute that deals with the Society. It's Chapter 138. We operate with a very consistent mission. The words change over time, but the mission remains the same. And this time we have actually, I have a phrase that I think describes the essence of what we are. And that is that our job is to illuminate the past, to make it shine so that people can see it and understand it, and to light the way into the future. I see us as very much connected to Minnesota's future. We connect people's lives to the past, and we try to give them perspective on what they're experiencing. And we also preserve the evidence. So when the time comes and people want to know what it was like to live in Minnesota at a given year, you pick it, 2009, we'll be there. The evidence will be preserved. And we tell stories. We are great storytellers. We like to say to you, in fact, there'll be buttons on us, and I hope we'll see them on you as well. We like to say that history matters. This means that we attempt to educate all of Minnesota's people, that we take that as our responsibility. We carry out core functions for the state of Minnesota. We are also, I think, essential to the tourism economy, and I think those of you who represent areas where you have historic sites know just how important we are to the tourism economy in the state. And we have a responsibility to future generations. As you plan what you're doing today to Minnesota, it's not just what happens to Minnesotans who are alive today. It's the impact on Minnesotans in the future. We do all our work, try to do all this through a variety of ways. We operate historic sites. These are the most significant historic places, we think, in Minnesota. You've thought that, too, because those sites are named in statute. We operate museums, the State History Museum at the History Center, and our Mill City Museum, which is in Minneapolis, and this year, actually it was in 2008, was 5 years old. In September we opened. We prepare exhibitions, like the one I described to you, that will deal with the Depression, the Second World War, and the boom period following. We have a library which is used both online and in person. Later in the presentation, you'll see a slide that I won't go through, but that will describe the extent of our collections. We preserve the state archives, which is a function of government. Those are the public records that are the records for the people of Minnesota. We publish books. We have a press that publishes about 2 books a month. We work with our sister organizations around the state, try to share our expertise with them. We make grants to them, both federal and state dollars that are re-granted to them, have been doing that since 1969. And as you think about the constitutional amendment and how those dollars might be distributed, one of the things you might keep in mind is that we are an organization that has been doing that for a long time, and we've done it, I think, very well. I can't think of a complaint we ever had about that program. We're active in historic preservation work, trying to take care of Minnesota's monuments and some of the vernacular places as well. And we also have an archaeology program, largely contract archaeology, helping DNR. One of the things that happens is that oftentimes natural resources and historic resources are in the same place. If you think about the national parks, that's true there. It's true in Minnesota as well. The historic sites are defined in statute. They are, as I mentioned, the most significant places in Minnesota, and they bring people, not only Minnesotans, and when we think about what people can do with the dollars that they have to stay close to home, whether it's a site in their own town or a site that's maybe 50 or 80 miles away. Yellowstone Park's a long way. Split Rock Lighthouse or the Forest History Center perhaps is in your own backyard. We also serve tourists who come to Minnesota from out of state as well. I think what we offer is educational. It's absolutely worthwhile. It's entertaining. It's been affordable. And it's really a destination for families. And the schools take advantage of our presence as well. We are increasingly, if there's one thing I could say about the Society's strategic plan going forward, it would be an increasing emphasis on our role in education, both formal and informal. I mentioned that you would see a slide about the vast collections we hold. I leave that to you. You can see what the extent of those collections is. It's pretty impressive. Obviously, it takes some effort to manage this operation. It doesn't just manage itself. And so we have a finance department that helps with that. We have people who work for us. We have to manage that aspect of our work to make sure that they're being treated and compensated fairly. And we also have a very large and effective IT function. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been talking about information technology. Now I am. What that has yielded is a website. And I have to remember, as I think all of you do, that actually our use, while in person is impressive, what's on the website is even greater. It's stunning to me. Things no sooner hit the website, people are all over them immediately. We also do some business development on the site. We sell memberships. We raise money. We sell some things on our site. And that's an aspect, I think, of our work that has some potential for expansion, but it doesn't happen overnight. We're out there in Minnesota with our services. Nearly 700,000 visitors went to our historic sites last year. That's a lot of people. 230,000 plus visitors came to the History Center. Well over a quarter of a million, some 270,000 school children have visited our historic sites, the History Center and Mill City Museum. 30,000 Minnesota kids participate in History Day, and they go off to the national competition and win big time for Minnesota. The year that was most stunning was when we took almost a third of the prizes nationally. And Minnesota's a relatively small state in terms of our population, but our kids do well. And part of the reason that they do well is that we're working with the schools, we're working with the teachers, we're working with these kids, we're working with the county and local historical societies. The resources are there for education. If there ever were an investment to make, this is the one.
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Archibald or Mr. Kelleher, do you have particular projects that can involve youth programs, not through schools, but through scouts, for instance?
We have certainly scout programs. I'd have to bring to you the list of programs, but it's not just schools that come to us. But if you're at the History Center some evening, you'll see scouts there. You'll see various clubs and so forth that come. So there's a lot for young people that we offer.
I ask because my granddaughter has somebody she's working with out of the St. Paul system somewhere and gave me his telephone number. But he was looking for something that could some statewide initiative that would involve the youth from the Girl Scouts. And I did not think of sending them to the History Center because I thought that was really obvious. But I did give him a couple other referrals. But as long as you, I think I'll call him back and may call you.
That's
a
great idea, Senator.
I'm not sure. He wasn't specific about what they were looking for, but it's a project for the Girl Scouts.
We have young people who work as volunteers. Along with our regular employee corps, we have about 1,700 volunteers who work with us. Okay. And among those are young people. And at the end of each year, we give a scholarship to a couple of kids who've just done extraordinary
great
volunteer
incentive.
Work for us. And they go off to college. We know where they're going. And oftentimes we track these kids. One of our most creative staff members right now is a History Day student who was at, I can't think of the suburb's name. It starts with H. Edina Hopkins, a kid who went to Hopkins High School and did a number of video projects that were winners with History Day. He went on to New York University, went to the Tisch School, which is one of the premier places for people interested in video and photographic production and film and so forth, has come back to us and is one of our youngest and most successful employees, does a lot of the work that we do to create experiences. So when kids get connected to us, either through their schoolwork or through a club or as volunteers, some of them stay engaged and really get started on something pretty special.
Well, I'll make sure to, if you give me a phone number before we leave today, I'll make sure to give it to him. And
please do, Senator.
Maybe he'll be calling you soon.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that completes the part of my presentation that's the overview, and I'd like to turn to my colleague David Kelleher to give you a bit. Oh, yeah, David reminds me that I need to come back. I told you I'd come back to the beginning, which was about hope and about the real value of our message. And I guess what I'd like to leave you with are words that were written by Elmer Anderson, late Governor Anderson, who I think was probably one of our really great Minnesotans. I used to think he mentored me, and I thought I was his only mentor, and I soon realized after he died that he had many, many, many mentees in this state. But he wrote to the society. He said, "There is no question that the values that built the past are essential to our future, but we cannot assume that they will be automatically adopted by future generations. The Minnesota Historical Society is a vital factor in preserving the best of the past and projecting it into the future. You folks are worrying about the future of Minnesota. We want to be a part of it. We can be a part of it. We are a part of it."
Okay.
Senator Thomasoni, I'd like to turn it over to David Kelleher to say a few words about the numbers or to answer any questions
Any questions of Ms. Archibald before I turn it over to Senator Saxon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Archibald, I was happy to hear another group that came in my office was the Minnesota Science Museum, and they talked about how you had worked with them, complimented them, and by working together, I think makes for a very effective couple of organizations in the state. You don't do the same thing, but you're very close in your education process.
That's true, Senator Saxon. I might just mention in the science area that we're right now preparing an exhibition on Benjamin Franklin, which will open at the History Center, and it will travel around the country as well. We'll be sharing it with other institutions as well. But there, we're working with the Bakken Museum in Minneapolis, lending us some artifacts, doing some co-programming with us. They're working with us hand in glove, and that's all a good thing. Partnerships are what it's all about.
I've been told when I have my reading glasses on that I look like Benjamin Franklin, but I don't know.
From here to there.
The glasses?
Yeah.
I can never fly a kite, though, so.
Yeah, be careful, Senator, please.
Senator Saxhug.
Maybe we should all write on a piece of paper what we think you look like.
There, I mean,
you're not wearing the right hat. That's
with reading glasses.
Let's not, because Metzen will be drawing pictures pretty quick here, and then we'll get in trouble.
So, we'll have a museum exhibit.
Yeah, we'll have an exhibit. Okay, I'm sorry. Any further questions of Ms. Archibald? You already did it already? Okay, Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, the next several slides will give you a quick snapshot of the Society's budget, and I'll walk through those quickly. And also, I think in your books you have something that looks like this. So if you have any questions from those pages, we can take a quick look at those as well. The Society's base operating budget from the last or the current biennium for fiscal year 2008 appropriation was $26,800,000. Second year of the biennium, $24.4 million. And the governor's recommendation for the next biennium, fiscal years 10 and 11, $21,758,000,
$21,642,000. Mr. Keller, just a question. I think initially in the December allotment, you weren't included, right? And did you suddenly come up with $600,000 to the bad?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And the governor's unallotment recommendation initially did not include the Society, and it's part of the state agency $40 million allocation. And then in sort of as we understand it, a second round, we were notified that there would be a $600,000 reduction.
And have you figured out where it's coming from?
We are in the process of working that out, and certainly come through a combination of savings from positions that are being held open and just squeezing down and a number of other things, but we're putting the final touches on that budget unallocation that we received news of just a couple of weeks ago.
Senator, we should be able to get back to you on that one very shortly, but you all should be aware that we have had a hiring freeze since August. We saw the storm clouds looming.
You did?
And we've had a hiring freeze, and I think we got to that probably before anybody else did. We also are curbing expenses in a very, very rigorous way at this point. So we're hoping to get through the $600,000 without having to do any permanent layoffs, because we're in the strategic planning process, and we're going to try to get our act together to know where we're going and not make this do what's going to be required of us, what we fear, in a piecemeal way. We need to do it in a thoughtful way. Thoughtful, however, does not necessarily mean not painful. It's going to be painful.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kelleher, and maybe you're going to get to this. I hope I'm not jumping the gun. I'm just wondering whether with the cuts that you've already seen and that the governor is projecting, if you think that you'll be able to make any of that up with the other sections in the pie chart, or if those revenues are also decreasing in reaction to the economy that we're in.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that was the next point I was going to make. The money that you provide through state general fund dollars is supplemented by other funds, such as admission revenues at historic sites and the History Center, donations from individuals and corporations, memberships, various grants. In the current economic climate, those dollars are even more difficult to obtain than they ever have been before. So we're finding it more difficult to make up losses in state appropriations from those other sources. We've been very aggressive over the years in seeking those funds. I would say we've been successful. We've been able to present a better product to the people of Minnesota to supplement the funds that you provide, but it's a challenge in this climate.
Mr. Chairman, I think one could reasonably describe this as the perfect storm. It's coming at us from all sides.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of other bits of information about the budget. When you calculate how much it costs per Minnesotan through the state appropriation, it's approximately $4.80 per year to provide the services that we provide to the people of Minnesota, historic sites and publishing that you hopefully had a chance to take a look at, and we think that's a pretty good deal for Minnesotans to spend less than $5 each per year. On staff, we have 180 full-time employees, full-time equivalents, And then approximately 200 full-time equivalents of part-time, seasonal, and other employees, just to give you a sense of how many people carry out this work. Again, the governor's budget recommendation is a reduction of $2.7 million each year, $5.5 million for the biennium. That represents a 15% reduction in our state general fund budget. I should mention that Department of Finance, Minnesota Management and Budget, when they calculated the budget, they did take out the fixed costs that we are not able to cut. For example, the debt service on the History Center, which is included in our budget, unlike a number of other agencies. Obviously, we can't cut that. That goes to the bondholders who invested in those bonds. Finance took those dollars out and then made their calculation. So it's a 15% on that smaller base. But if you calculate the overall impact, it's just under 12%, 11.5% reduction on our budget. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we do have challenges in the other areas of our non-state general fund revenues, the site's admissions, book sales. Book sales across the country are down by almost a third, and we publish books for people, and people just aren't buying them as much, so that has an impact on our individual donations that are I'll pause for a second in case anyone has questions in the budget book. The most helpful page on your budget books is page 4, which gives you a quick snapshot. That page is labeled Agency Overview. It gives you a quick snapshot of a number of the figures that I just quickly walked through, breaks it down in a number of different ways by salaries, compensation, grants, and other ways.
And Mr. Killer, on your slide, you've got 180 full-time employees and 200 part-time employees. The budget book makes it look like there's 380 full-time employees.
Mr. Chairman, the figure that's on the slide is the current number of employees. And the figure that's in the column in the governor's recommendation is an approximation. We have not figured out the exact impact of staff, but that's the best approximation of what the staff complement would look like after that reduction. So what's in the slide is a reflection of what we have currently.
But on the budget book, then, it's full-time and part-time included in the number.
All combined together for that 383 or 384 figure.
And then you wouldn't know exactly where you would be cutting to get 50 less employees, it looks like.
At this moment, Mr. Chair, we do not, and we will continue the conversation with you and the committee members as we refine the.
Did you have any experience in the past when you had to make cuts and lay people off and have a smaller budget? Did it have any kind of an impact on your admissions? Do you have the same people come through the gates? Did you get more? What do you know what happened?
Mr. Chairman, the last time we made these budget cuts and laid people off, we did not have a charge at the History Center, which obviously is the place that draws the most, single place that draws the most people. I can tell you that when we began to reduce hours in order to make the budget balance, and we were closed 2 days a week, opening at whatever it was at noon, closing at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, I looked at that and watched what was happening as people were coming to the door and finding the door locked. I think it was finally one day when I saw a father appear with 2 or 3 children at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and saw a sign that said closed. I said, this is it. We're going to have to charge admission so that we can keep these doors open. And so that was the final straw. And so it's a little hard to tell at this point because when we made the cuts before, one of the ways in which we responded, at least at the History Center, was to put a charge on. Charge is $8. Is $8 for an adult, which is not insubstantial. You have a family of 4 come. Kids want to go to the cafeteria and have something to eat. They want cookies and chocolate milk or whatever. Pretty soon, you got a $40 bill. And for people who are out of work today, that's not a good place to be.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, a quick final word on the legacy amendment. As you all know. The language in the Constitution that, as Ms. Archibald mentioned a couple of moments ago, the Constitution now includes the words Minnesota history, which we think is pretty cool. Ms. Archibald mentioned the Minnesota Historical Society has a long track record of operating programs for the public. We have a long track record of operating competitive grant programs, and as you design how the constitutional amendment funds will be used, we would enjoy working with you to determine how the history piece of that works. We went out and had a series of public meetings with county and local historical societies, with historic preservation folks, with archaeology folks. We're in Grand Rapids, St. Peter, St. Cloud, and Fort Snelling to hear what folks had to say and to tell them a little bit more about the amendment. And what became clear was there's a lot of need out there with local historical organizations. We know that over the past few years, the programs that the Historical Society operates have eroded. So needs in the areas of historic sites, local history, historic preservation, archaeology, and technology are very evident to us as we gathered input from folks. So, again, we would enjoy working with you all in the coming weeks and months as you design a process to implement those funds, obviously, particularly as it relates to Minnesota history.
Well, just having a couple of quasi-museums in my district, like Iron World and the Hockey Hall of Fame, it's pretty obvious what happens when you cut budgets, and historical records aren't kept, and displays aren't kept up, and trying to attract people to the places is more and more difficult all the time. So budget cutting is a pretty serious thing, and even in our museums, and it ends up having a real negative effect on what we decide to keep track of and what we don't keep track of. And I guess you guys have gone through it, so you know exactly what I'm talking about.
We have, and I think for the county and local historical organizations, local places like the ones in your district, I think they've seen a glimmer of hope that's come through the legacy amendment. Certainly the people of Minnesota have indicated some things that are important to them. And I think
I did notice there were no little red things in my district on your map.
Mr. Chair, if we included the grants that have gone out over 40 years, I can assure you that they're there have been a lot of them, and our director has signed a lot of grant letters to you and your colleagues.
I believe so.
Good. Happy to hear that. Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, I guess, is for either one of you, but there's been a lot of discussion about the legacy amendment funds and making sure that they're not being used to backfill the budget, especially when we have this deficit. So my first question is, from what you can tell in the governor's proposal, is there any use of that money incorporated in the number that he's proposing? And if not, how, you know, just generally, how do you have any recommendations about allaying that concern or where the money could go that would fit within the intent of that?
Senator Olson, I think you've put your finger on the sort of paradox of the day, which is, you know, take it away here, and then the people of Minnesota are wanting to grant it here, and how do those things come together? What the governor's intent was, I think only the governor knows. I don't know what is. He's certainly not spoken to me about trying to exchange one kind of money for another. That's not been part of the picture, but I think that's the challenge ahead. How do we somehow keep these two pieces in the right balance and be, I think, honest to the intent of the people of the state? It's a huge challenge. I don't know the answer to it. David, do you want to add anything to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I guess just to add one point, as far as the governor's budget goes, I'm not aware of any link between the legacy amendment and what's in our budget.
Well, and I think it's hard to tell at this point in time. I know the language in the amendment specifically states that we aren't supposed to use legacy money to fund budgets, but at the same time, it's hard to say if you were to cut a program in your budget and then fund it through the legacy amendment through some other means or some other name or something similar, as to whether or not that would be supplanting the money in the budget or not. So I think that's something that we have to explore here and try and figure out exactly whether or not this legacy amendment can be used in in more versatile ways than what we think it can be used.
Senator, I think the worst nightmare is to imagine that you would take down the capacity of the organization and then ask it to do some new things when it doesn't have the capacity to do the things, the basics that you want us to do. And I think that's where the real rub comes for us.
Because in the actual constitutional amendment, not what was on the ballot, but in the amendment, and that's what applies to this committee, it says it may be spent only for arts, arts education, and arts access, and to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. So those are the words in the Constitution. So I guess we'll have to figure out how to interpret that. Okay, any other questions? If not, thank you both very much, and I guess we'll be in touch.
Thank you very much, Senator Tomasoni, and all of you. We appreciate the care, and we certainly are. We wish you the very best in all of this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Got it.
Housing Finance Agency, as soon as they're out of there, you can jump up there.
Recommending something.
That wireless stuff is looking better and better all the time, isn't it? Ms. Orr, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tanya Orr with the Housing Finance Agency. With me is Jeanette Blanken. We're going to share responsibilities for the budget presentation. The commissioner sends his apologies. He was out of town. He's out of town and is unable to attend today's hearing. Mr. Chair, we thought we would do three things today, quickly. We want to give you sort of a high-level view of sort of the outputs for the appropriations that you have made in the recent past to the Housing Finance Agency. We also wanted to describe some level of detail the programs that state appropriations fund so that you get a sense of what you're buying. And then finally, we will talk about the change items and how the governor's proposed budget is structured for 10 and 11. We have a handout. Looks like this, I think.
Yep, we got it.
Because we find the budget pages sometimes a little dense to get through. So we've summarized it, and hopefully it's a little easier to follow. The second slide in your handout is the mission statement and the strategic priorities for the Housing Finance Agency.
And Ms. Orr, as you go through it, I think, and maybe you're going to do this, but just in case you're not, I think it would be helpful to let everybody know where we're looking at general fund money and where we're looking at money that's coming from somewhere else, whether it be bonding or whatever it might be, because I think that there's a real lot of money in this agency that isn't general fund money, and it might be confusing to some of the members. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, our intention today was to talk almost exclusively about the general fund,
okay,
since that's the part that I think you probably have the most interest in. So as you can see, we have four strategic priorities. To finance new affordable housing opportunities. We use that word very carefully because housing opportunities both are bricks and mortar but also can be rental assistance. To preserve the existing housing, because that is cheaper to preserve existing housing than to build new in almost all cases. To try and end long-term homelessness and to increase the home ownership rate among households of color. Over the course of 2 years, we serve approximately almost 130,000 households with a total of nearly $1.5 billion. Most of that money is either bond resources or federal resources. As you can see from the slide on page 5, the state appropriations are less than 10% of our total budget, But it is an incredibly critical 10% of our budget. It is the money that allows the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to serve far lower incomes than many of the other state housing finance agencies. It allows us to do things like have a strategic priority to try and end long-term homelessness or address the gap between the home ownership rate among white households and households of color. We, as you can see, spent to construct new housing units. Nearly 90% of the new units constructed were rental housing, not single-family housing. And we also used money to prevent homelessness as well as try and house people who have already become homeless. We had a doubling of the state appropriations to prevent homelessness in this last biennium, which we are seeking to preserve. As I said, Chart 5 gives you a breakdown of how the agency's resources are divided up.
So the $35 million that's on slide 4, prevented homelessness, that's doubling from what year?
Mr. Chair, the doubling was in the Family Homeless Prevention Program, which went from about $7.5 million to nearly $15 million. But there are other programs that also are used to prevent homelessness. For instance, the Housing Trust Fund that provides housing at very low-income people will help people become homeless. And the Bridges Program, which provides rental assistance for people who are mentally ill. So the doubling was from the Family Homeless Prevention Program from the 06-07 to 08-09.
Okay.
Slide 6 gives you an indication of the incomes of the households we serve. As you can see, well over half of the households that we serve have annual incomes of less than $20,000. The programs that serve that incomes are primarily Bridges, Family Homeless, the Housing Trust Fund, and the Section 8 programs. Slide 7 gives you a picture of where our money is spent. We don't, for the most part, say, you know, the metro area is going to get X percentage of the of our resources, and Northeast is going to get another X percent. We mostly are responding to requests for proposals that are submitted to us. But as you can see, the result is that for the most part, the money is evenly distributed in terms of a region's eligible share of the households. So slide 8, this is sort of the big picture of the proposed budget. And what activities will be funded under the proposed 10 and 11 budget. The main point here is that we are going to be able to continue to fund all the activities that we have funded in the past. Some will be at a slightly reduced amount, but we will be able to continue all of the activities that we have done in the past. And Jeanette is going to give
us... And then on that slide, is any of that money on that slide general fund money?
This is all general fund money.
That's all general fund money.
And Jeanette is going to discuss some of the activities.
Thanks, Tanya. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jeanette Blankenship from Minnesota Housing. And I will give you an overview of basically the 5 activity areas that you see on this pie chart on page 8, which will give you a sense of what we're doing within each activity area for the programs, again, like Tanya said, to get a sense of what you're getting for the money that you invest. So first, for development and redevelopment. This activity area serves low and moderate income wage earners and provides for construction, acquisition, rehabilitation, and a variety of financing tools to help construct and redevelop or rehab affordable housing. The only program in this area for the general fund is the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program, which supports development and redevelopment activities by leveraging private and local resources. It provides grants and deferred interest loans for both rental and owner-occupied housing. It's notable that given the current market conditions, we've seen a decline in the new construction use for this program for homeowners. I do have examples for each program activity area, but given the limited time, we're going to kind of
go ahead. Give me an example.
All right, so for single family on the Challenge Fund, we have an example of At Home in Duluth, which is a community-based collaboration which has received Challenge Funds since 1999. They target identified community rehab needs, and since 99, 354 units have been rehabilitated, totaling $4.2 million from the Challenge Fund. And the rehab activities include things like energy improvements, heating and plumbing upgrades. Recently, they rehabbed a house that didn't have running water because of pipe issues, and it would have been deemed uninhabitable by the city of Duluth. But this challenge program through At Home in Duluth allowed the family to remain in the home. In the last fall funding round in 2008, At Home in Duluth was awarded $432,000 from the challenge program, but leveraged $4 million from the community from government and nonprofit contributions.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add that the challenge program, there's a reason why it's called what it's called, because it was designed so that the state would put some money up for housing, but then there is an expectation that 50% of the money be used for projects that have either a business or a local unit of government or a philanthropic contribution. So it does leverage other resources by the design of the program, and the state is sort of challenging non-state resources to also help with the housing issues.
So our multifamily example on slide 11 is an example of a local business who met that challenge. JBS Swift & Co. is expanding in the Worthington area and put up $50,000 into this development for a 24-unit rental townhouse development. To help, I mean, they recognize there's a shortage of housing in the area as they expand, and they're having to bus in employees from a long way away. So investing in the local community helps stabilize their business. We want to point out that all of our new construction through the green, through the challenge program, has to meet green building standards through the green communities. So, for example, in this development, they will have water-conserving and Green Star appliances, no VOC paints, green floor coverings, et cetera.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Green Star appliances, et cetera, triggered a memory.
A bad one.
It's a good it's a very good one, as a matter of fact. It's reflecting on a conversation I had earlier today about the fact that we have economic recovery dollars coming into Minnesota that are going to a lot be really geared towards energy efficiency and rehab and making sure that existing housing stock is preserved and using energy more efficiently. Has the Housing Finance Agency been taking a look at that and seeing if programs and services and the funds are aligned to be able to receive some of those dollars in order to put them out into production for homeowners for this purpose?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, we have actually, with the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, the federal money that was appropriated in July, we have said to all of the potential grantees of that money that when you rehab a home that's been foreclosure vacant, that you must meet certain energy conservation standards or green standards. So we have already implemented, which we hope will put us in a good position. We also have all of our new construction that we finance has to meet these green criteria. And we are in technical discussions about how do we impose those requirements on rehab that we fund as well. So, and there are a couple of things that we're looking at and also some things that we've done. We've made our home improvement loan program available as a microenergy loan to try and encourage households to get an energy audit and then borrow money from us to make the energy conservation improvements. There are some things like we've heard recently about Berkeley has a program to finance solar panels for homeowners and has issued bonds for that and then has a property assessment. So we're looking into things like that
I think we're probably in a pretty good shape in terms of being able to use that money in Minnesota for energy conservation.
Senator Dew.
Thank you. Well, that's good news. This bill is going to be finalized and signed by the president in a mere matter of weeks. And I've heard, you know, different estimates ranging from $100 to $200 million that could come into Minnesota specifically for purpose of energy efficiency improvements to both residential and public buildings. I don't know about commercial buildings. And those are jobs. So, I mean, that's very much geared towards the goal of the economic recovery package. That's putting people into buildings, doing the audits, and then, you know, contractors in doing the retrofits and the whatever else is needed based on what those audits find. So to the extent that we can be super sure that we're really ready, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, one of the things that we're doing internally is staff, actually today was the deadline and I haven't gotten it yet, but staff was actually charged with going through and looking at every project that we have made commitments for or are about to make commitments for and tell us which one of those projects would really be shovel ready in 120 days. And so it is our intention that this week we would have a list together that would tell you, you know, how much more funding is necessary in order to get those where they'd be ready to go, but also the number of projects and where they would be located. So I'm hoping that we will have that really shortly, that's something that we have said that we will communicate to the congressional delegation as well.
Thank you.
Senator Cook.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, you know, I understand with the conservation aspect and the ideas that going forward, but with the no VOC paints, I noticed, green label floor coverings, I'm just kind of wondering what's the philosophy on that, and does that add a great deal to the cost of these new buildings at the front end? And what are the savings that can be expected? What is the conservation aspect of those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Koch, we are in the process of working with the University of Minnesota on a study to understand what the green premium might be and what the savings are. So we have a number of projects that are we have some like a control group of rental housing projects that are similar designs to ones that have the green criteria. Have met the green criteria. And we are hoping that in the next year we will have that study completed. We're contracting with the university to do that. The theory behind the low VOC paint and the I don't know what you call it, environmentally sensitive or friendly, like carpet glues and things like that, is simply that there are people who have really bad reactions to those things. That is a health cost, ultimately. And the low VOC paint doesn't have a significantly higher cost. So if you offset what the potential for some health problems, it seems like it's worth the cost.
But Mr. Chair, but do we have number? That's what I'm asking. We're requiring this in all houses going forward, correct? And possibly a new rehab. And yet we haven't worked out those numbers. We're not sure. Is that fair to say we're in the process of studying what those numbers might be?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't say that we have a definitive study, but the Housing Finance Agency has been in existence for more than 30 years. We have architects on staff. We looked through every single one of the green criteria, and they used their knowledge and experience to say this is worth the cost, this isn't worth the cost. So we have a body of knowledge that we brought to those decisions.
Thank you.
Ms. Orr, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, could I just follow up on that, on Senator Cokes?
Absolutely.
What were the criteria used for them to determine whether it was worth it or not? I mean, because you said they decide with their information it was worth it or not worth it.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it was really based on their knowledge of what the costs are versus what they have observed as being the return, the savings. So we adopted this green criteria a couple of years ago, which was a national standard that we adapted for Minnesota. And it's one of the only affordable residential housing green criteria in the country. Many of the elements of the green criteria were things that over the course of the years the agency has learned are cost-effective and have implemented or encouraged developers to use anyhow. So in a lot of ways, this wasn't much of a leap for us because there were things that over the course of our business we learned were good practices and were encouraging or requiring anyhow.
I asked all the experts at the front here, and no one knows what it stands for, so I'm going to ask you, what does VOC stand for?
Volatile compounds.
Did we Google it? Is that what we did? Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
I'll move on to our next activity area in homeownership loans. These are loans that serve first-time homebuyers. They're deferred loans at 0% interest for down payment assistance, and they're repaid when the home is sold, so they actually recycle. The median income served by these first-time homebuyer, they're basically a down payment assistance loan, is $45,000. And the primary program funded through the general fund is the Home Ownership Assistance Fund, or HAF. An example quickly is a typical case. We all know that budgets go quickly with increasing food and transportation, childcare, healthcare costs, and many can afford a mortgage, but just need a little extra down payment assistance to actually get into the home to afford that mortgage, especially in these markets as down payment requirements are increasing. So provided as an example of what you might see, someone who earns $45,000, is looking to purchase a home that they can afford the mortgage, it's $160,000, but they just need a little extra of their down payment. Current requirements are 3 to 3.5% for down payment assistance, and something like the HAF program would allow them to get into the home and be able to afford that mortgage. Next activity area is the homelessness prevention and supportive housing activity area, which serves a continuum of at-risk, homeless, and long-term homeless populations. It provides rental assistance, temporary assistance in emergencies, operating subsidies, and financial assistance with capital costs of rental housing for very low-income households. And there are actually three state-appropriated programs, which Tanya already mentioned in this area: Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program, the Housing Trust Fund, and Bridges. And these are delivered through local HRAs, community action partnerships, counties, for-profit, and nonprofit developers. The business plan, I don't know, most of you are on this committee the past couple years, so are aware of the business plan, but just to remind you, we have a goal of 4,000 new housing opportunities by 2010. And we're on track to this goal, though these last 2 years are really going to be a challenge.
Ms. Blankenship, remind me what Bridges is.
Bridges, it serves, I'll get to an example, but it serves those with mental health or mental just illness.
And, Mr. Chair, it's called Bridges because it's the state bridge from a state institution to the federal Section 8 program. So it's intended to be a temporary rental assistance program until people can get onto the federal program. That's why it's called Bridges.
Okay.
So on slide 15, you'll see just we don't show our business plan and long-term homeless here because that's just housing opportunities. We also want to figure out the effectiveness of once you house a long-term homeless and find them housing opportunities, making sure they're actually staying in housing. That's really how we measure our effectiveness here. And so 88% last year of formerly long-term homeless were still in housing or had a positive exit at the end of the report year, and positive exit would be finding other stable housing. We also want to make sure they continue to stay in. So for those that were in housing at least a year last year, 75% of them continued to remain in housing or had a positive exit.
So the ones that had the positive exit, do you track them after they leave the programs to see if they stay in housing?
Absolutely.
Or will they just kind of become another number if they get back into the homelessness? What, how does that work?
Mr. Chair, the way that we track them is actually if they're in a system that's tracked through the Homeless Management Information System, HMIS. And so if they go off on their own and aren't requiring any other sort of federal or state assistance, we probably won't know what happens to them. What we will know is if they come back into the system, which would not be a positive thing.
I've got to assume that a lot of the success here is people getting some kind of work also. Is that calculated in this? Or?
Mr. Chair, I don't have those figures, but we certainly can try and get them through the HMIS system and see what we can find out about.
Do you know intuitively if that's part of it? Or?
There were two things in particular that we thought would be positive stabilization factors. One would be to get people onto a mainstream support program such as SSI, and the other would be to get people into work. Certainly for the families with children, we expected that the positive income outcome would be primarily getting people into work. And we have served a fair number of families with children, so I would expect that, particularly for those, that yes, that would. Employment is the way that they become stabilized.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, another example for the homeless prevention and supportive housing activity area with the Family Homeless Prevention Program. Last year, it served 8,600 households and nearly 22,000 individuals. And you'll see some of the numbers for the households that, you know, over half are families. And we're seeing an increase in the families with children that are in shelters and in need of assistance. This current biennium had a focus on veterans and youth, and we actually partner with veteran organizations like the County Veteran Service Officers and the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, as well as school homeless liaisons, to make sure we were reaching those populations, and did see an increase this past couple years in the numbers served in those areas.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could back up to the first bullet, the breakout of families, youth, and singles. The youth part, is that youth with their families or youth on their own or youth solitary?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, youth are under 21 or 21 and under. So that's usually their children are with families. Youth are independent.
Thank you.
And are these numbers... these are the numbers served. Do we know what percentage of the need is being served? Or is that hard to calculate, too?
Mr. Chair, the only good way we have of calculating the need is how much demand goes unmet from each of the programs. And I can tell you that some programs run out of money, like, in the first 10 days of the month. What I don't know is whether they keep track of the people that they can't serve. We don't have programs that have money sitting around at the end of a quarter or the end of a fiscal year. So all of the family homeless prevention money, which is almost $15 million, is used and used in a very timely fashion. But most programs have people that they can't serve.
What runs out in 10 days?
Mr. Chair, a lot of the programs will divide the money that they get for a two-year period up into each month, you know, 12 portions. And so whoever comes into the door the first part of the month is more likely to get served than if you come in with an emergency at the end of the month. And so if you're a program that sort of divides your money up into monthly allotments, then some of those programs will run out of money for that month in the first 10 days or so.
You
so
have one on the top of your head? Which one runs out?
There's a program in southeast Minnesota that regularly reports that they run out of money.
And that is providing shelter, food,
Mr. Chair, they're providing a whole variety of things. They may be providing security deposits and first month rent, for somebody who needs to move. They may be providing services, what we call rapid exit, to get somebody out of a shelter, so they'll work with the family and find a landlord who would be willing to take this family and get them out of the shelter as quickly as possible. Sometimes it's somebody will call and say, my car broke down. If I don't have a car, I can't get to work. And if I can't get to work, I can't pay my rent. And so they'll help meet the car repair expenses. You know, the furnace broke down. It's a whole variety of things. It's an emergency assistance in large part, try and get people so that they're stable and they don't have to lose their home.
So if they divide their apportionment into 12 months, do they ever move 1 month to the previous month because they have so much need, or they just let it go unmet?
Mr. Chair, some programs have decided that they're going to sort of preserve their money so that they don't, you know, they don't end up with the last 6 months not having any money at all. And so they will just say, sorry, we've run out of money. We can't help you. If you still are, you know, if we could still help you next month, come back next month.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some other organizations have taken a stab at trying to figure out what the need is out there. I mean, certainly there's the Wilder report of folks who are homeless. They go out and take a snapshot of everyone they can find on a given day. And then, you know, working with the CAP agencies and others, I know they try to compile the numbers and figure out who's living on other people's sofas, who's marginally housed, who's at risk. And so we have some sense of the numbers out there from other organizations. People in this room can help us out with that.
You're on the subcommittee, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, when I was back home this last weekend, one of the things that I heard about was the sticker shock that a lot of people have had lately when they've gotten their electric bills, partly, you know, because of how cold the weather has been, and partly, I think, maybe with some increased rates. And I'm just wondering, is there any interaction as far as, like, fuel assistance programs and what you do, and does that get factored in at all, that we want to help people stay in their homes and not and make it through this winter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, absolutely. In outside the metro area, some of the providers of family homeless prevention services are the CAPS. And so they have access to both the family homeless prevention money and energy assistance or weatherization money. We have been very flexible and open about whatever your emergency is that risks your losing your housing is the emergency that should be addressed. So if it's we can't meet the utility bill this month, then that is then that's the assistance that you would get. The only caveat is that we do have all of the providers be clear that if, for instance, you've got $1,000 in income and your mortgage is $1,000 and you're not going to have more income in the next month, that you don't pay, you know, you don't pay for something that's not going to resolve the emergency. So if you're way over your head, maybe what they can help you with is moving to someplace that you can't afford. So that is the one thing that they do look at.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll move on to preservation of existing housing, and we'll try to move as quickly as possible. This serves lowest-income households, like Ms. Orr said, through programs that preserve existing homes, and it's often the most affordable way to keep them in. It provides deferred and amortizing loans to rehabilitate homes and rental property. This is provided through two programs that the General Fund funds, the Rehabilitation Loan Program, and the Affordable Rental Investment Fund for Preservation, which we call PARIF. In fiscal year 2008, or federal fiscal year, 60% of the loans included energy conservation component. And rehab loans are really important to both keep homeowners in their homes and also to make the home more affordable itself, like you said, Senator Olson, by reducing energy costs. That's one thing. If you improve energy efficiency, you are improving the affordability of the home. So I'm going to briefly skip over examples. I want to point out on slide 19 that PARIF leverages for every dollar of assistance, every preservation dollar that we invest in rental housing here in Minnesota, we preserve $5.20 in federal assistance. So it's really important to protect this leverage. And again, PARIF is used for rental housing that it has federal assistance on it. The final activity area is resident and organizational support, which supports our partner delivery infrastructure, which is necessary to effectively deliver affordable housing here in Minnesota. We have two state appropriated programs, the Homeownership Education Counseling and Training, or HECAT, and Capacity Building. And I'm going to skim over those examples so we can get to our budget presentation. We do want to first talk about the jobs created. So we'll be at slide 22, and I'm going to turn it back over to Assistant Commissioner Orr.
Mr. Chair, we have recently undertaken a study to look at what is the economic impact of the money that the housing finance agencies invest in housing. We talk a lot, as we just had this afternoon, about who we serve, but there also is this part about the money that's spent on housing also employs people, as Senator Dibble mentioned. So our recent analysis is that for every $1 million that's spent on a new construction rental building, we employ 16 FTEs for every $1 million. For every $1 million of rehab that's funded by the Minnesota Housing, 15 FTEs are jobs are produced. So if we have a study that we've included in the handouts. It's called The Economic Impact of Minnesota Housing's Investments. Really exciting title. But one of the things that...
way easier than VOC.
Yeah. but one of the things that we found from looking at our spending over a two-year period is that for every $1 million that the state invests, another $1.9 or almost $2 million in economic activity is generated. So we have an example for you of a project, which is a relatively small project for rental housing to tax in the metro area. And for this $427,000 that we invested, the state invested, 6.5 jobs were created. So I think that it's important, particularly these days, to think about not only the people that are getting housed, but the jobs that are being created. And in Minnesota, in the construction industry, it's particularly important because
Are these agency jobs we're creating?
These are jobs in the private sector. Residential construction jobs. These are accountants and architects and lawyers and bookkeepers and things like that.
Okay.
The agency's jobs have been pretty much flat. slide 24 is just a list of the measurements that we use to track the program effectiveness. We also have another management tool that we call the Balanced Scorecard that looks at how are we doing in terms of the money that we invest. We also look at additional measurements such as we've presented to you today about how long are people in the housing that we provide and what sorts of incomes do they serve. So we are looking at and using it as a management tool in determining how we structure our programs and how we use our money to look at the effectiveness of programs. We had three principles that we used or priorities to guide our budget recommendations this biennium. They were that we would try and preserve as much of the funding for programs that serve the most vulnerable populations. We would try and protect programs that leverage non-state resources, particularly federal resources, and we would live up to the commitments that we think we made under the business plan to end long-term homelessness. So those priorities guided our decisions. The governor is recommending a base budget for the agency of $85.4 million, which is a 5% cut to the base. We had, as you can see on slide 26, significant one-time only appropriations last biennium. If we're just looking at the base, it's a 5% cut under the governor's recommendations. We have five change items to get to this budget. The first one is a 5% is a reduction to the challenge program. We are recommending that the 5% base reduction come from the challenge program for a couple of reasons. One is that at this point in time, it doesn't seem like we need to do a lot of funding of new construction of single-family owner-occupied housing. We have a pretty good stock of that in general. Secondly, the agency, the state as a whole, received $58 million from the feds in July. We haven't actually got the money, but we have a promise of it, for foreclosure neighborhood remediation. The Housing Finance Agency has $38 million of that money. And since foreclosures seem to be the sort of most pressing housing problem right now, or one of the most pressing, and we have a federal resource, we thought it made sense to, if we had to take a reduction, that the reduction should come from a program that we could have some federal money, that we had federal money to backfill, and not take it out of a program where that wasn't the case. We are also recommending that the challenge fund be further reduced by $4 million, and that $4 million be reallocated to the Housing Trust Fund so that we could fulfill the commitments under the business plan to end long-term homelessness. We have a an item that doesn't show up as a change item but is a transfer from an appropriation that you made 2 years ago. We have money in a disaster relief contingency fund, which was money that's sitting in a fund waiting for a natural disaster to occur. We think we have a crisis now with the increase in families with children who are in emergency shelters. And so we're proposing that $1.5 million of the disaster relief contingency fund be moved from that fund to the Housing Trust Fund and used for rental assistance for families who are newly homeless to get them into stable housing. And we think that this is also an education proposal because we know that schools have a very difficult time when they've got classrooms with kids moving in and out all the time. And finally, we're asking that funding for rehabilitation, which is funded partly by state appropriations for single family now and by federal appropriations for multifamily, that those two funding sources be switched. And the reason that we're asking that is because we have learned that the federal funding for rental housing rehabilitation is, the compliance monitoring is very complicated. No state uses their federal home dollars in this way. We're the only ones, and we know now why. We are expecting that if we continue to use this funding source for rental rehabilitation, that we would have to add staff for compliance monitoring. If we do it for single-family rehabilitation, we don't have the same compliance monitoring requirements. So we're suggesting that we just switch the funding sources. So the last page in your handout is a what we hope is a good reference chart. Gives you the dollar amounts of the proposed base and the, where you can find it in the budget pages. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Chairman. Senator Metzen.
On this NSP money, Neighborhood Stabilization Program, the metro area, you got $38.8
million.
Is that the state allocation?
The state's allocation was $38.8 million to the Housing Finance Agency, and the total to the state was $58 million.
The state, okay, then, Mr. Chairman, then it's allocated what on the number of foreclosures in each city or county, or how does that work? And I see where Anoka County and a couple of cities got a bite out of the apple, and I looked up the numbers, and county I represent, Dakota County, is right up there with Anoka County and a number of foreclosures, and they got a few million or anyway, I'm not sure how the formula works. I think I wrote you a letter, and I was kind of concerned that, and I have no problem with Anoka County because I know their numbers are high, but my numbers, Mr. Chairman, members in the Dakota County area were a couple of cities with the first ring suburb, and including South St. Paul, West St. Paul, and Amber Grove Heights that are, it looks like two or three in each block, believe me. And and I'm not saying that about Bloomington or Apple Valley and what have you, but So I guess I don't know how we didn't get in on that, number one. And number two, how can we, I suppose you have to apply and go through the process. So I don't know if that's a question or a statement, but
question.
You know how I feel about that.
Mr. Chair.
I had to get it on the public record.
The federal law requires any entity receiving this NSP money to determine areas of greatest need. And the federal law says that among the factors that you must consider in determining areas of greatest need are both the number of foreclosures but the rate of foreclosure, as well as anticipated increases in foreclosures and the rate and number of subprime loans. So there were three big factors that we were required to consider in determining areas of greatest need. And then we could consider other factors as well. And we chose to consider a couple of other factors, which were looking at the incomes by zip code and comparing those incomes to the statewide average or median, and also looked at the age of the housing stock, the idea being that areas that had concentrations of lower income households were probably going to have a harder time bouncing back, and that areas that had older housing stock, usually the cost of rehabbing that was more expensive, and so that they may need additional funding. In Dakota County in particular, I can tell you that while they were not allocated additional money under our formula, they were eligible to apply for additional funding. And my recollection is that they have. And we will be making decisions about that. We will be making recommendations to our board at the end of February. The applications just came in like last Thursday, and we haven't had an opportunity to review any of them. So I can tell you, Senator, and I'm sure I said this in the letter, the center cities said we didn't get enough money under your formula. The suburbs said we didn't get enough money under the formula, and Greater Minnesota said we didn't get enough money under your formula. I had a similar conversation with Senator Tomasoni this fall about this.
Yeah, we didn't get enough under the formula.
So we either did something right or we did something really wrong, I guess.
Well, probably wrong, it looks like. No, we're still in the, Mr. Chairman, we're still in the process. And I know our zip code on our ways should fit into those three criteria that you are going forward.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at slide number 26. And I'm wondering, Zora, this is the where it talks about the difference between the base and one time only and then the change going forward. And I was trying to calculate here without a calculator, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like if you were to compare the overall numbers between the 08-09 budget and the 10-11 budget, we're looking at like a 24% decrease. And I'm just wondering, you know, if those one-time monies were for a need that's now gone away, or if it was just that was the only way we found the money to budget because we had a problem with the tails last time. So it seems to me that if we're going to be looking honestly and transparently with the public about how much money we're putting into housing then versus now, that it would probably be better to talk about a 24% cut if indeed, unless these were really one-time needs. And then I wonder if that's appropriate considering the difficulty people are experiencing right now with losing their homes, and is that really an area that should have that large a cut?
Your best name, sir.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, you're correct. It is a between 24 and 25% reduction if you look at the total appropriations. As you know, budgets are created based on the base. The one-time only money was significant, and it's not the only biennium that we've received significant one-time only appropriations. There is neither the 114 nor the 85 is enough to meet all of the affordable housing needs in this state. We did develop programs to use the 114 so that it didn't have that the parts that were not based, that were one-time only, didn't have tails. That's one of the advantages in housing is that if you use it for capital costs, you build that building, and then you can move on to building the new building or rehabbing the new building. So we are able to use effectively one-time only money. While we housed people with that money, that doesn't say that we housed everyone who needed affordable housing.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Orr, compared to a year ago, probably the need for assistance with housing is probably greater now than it was then, it seems like, and yet we're going to put almost 25% less money into meeting that need under the governor's proposal. I just want to make sure that that's not a misstatement, that that is, in fact, the proposal.
Mr. Chair, yes, the governor's proposal is to, if you compare the total budget for 08-09 to the total proposed budget for 10-11, it is 25% less.
It says 35% in the budget book.
It does?
Yep.
Well, sometimes my math isn't very good.
Well, and also the, based on the numbers in the budget book, it says 87 million in 08, and then in 10 it says 45 million, and that doesn't add up to 24 million in one-time money. It adds up to about 45 million in 42 million in one-time money.
So. Mr. Chair, you know, the reason that that's true is because we were focused on the regular session appropriation, and there was $18 million in money that was appropriated for the flood. And so I think that that is, there was $18 million for the Southeast Minnesota flood a year of last fall.
On top of the 24. That adds up, no. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Senator Kulesh.
Mr. Chair, Tanya, I'm just wondering how much you're working with the foreclosure crisis and how involved the agency is with local units of government on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kulesh, we actually have been very closely involved with the foreclosure crisis. We, over a year and a half ago, we awarded Minneapolis $10 million in loan funds and another $1 million in grant funds to address the remediation needs in North Minneapolis. We also awarded money to St. Paul for the similar purpose. We are in the process of contemplating a request from the Family Housing Fund to have a similar amount of money in loan funds be awarded to the Family Housing Fund for St. Paul. We have regularly in the last 2 years funded through state appropriations neighborhood remediation efforts. We also fund the foreclosure prevention counseling. We have state appropriations to do that. We're the recipient of federal funds, $4.3 million each year for foreclosure counseling. We put agency resources in over a year ago, $1 million for foreclosure counseling. So the counselor number has more than tripled in the last year. We are participants in the Foreclosure Prevention Partners Council and have been active in that council. We actually have, our board adopted a priority for the challenge program, a funding priority for foreclosure remediation efforts over a year ago, so that meant that projects that came in that were seeking funding to address the foreclosure issue would have a priority for funding. We have also we have federal money through the HOME program for down payment assistance, and we have made that available specifically for households who are looking to buy a foreclosed or vacant home. And we've made almost $10 million available in down payment and closing cost assistance for that effort. And we have regularly examined whether we could help with refinancing. We have not concluded that we have an economically viable product, nor has any state HFA found an economically viable refinancing product, but we regularly look at that. We recently The board recently approved a purchase rehab product that we would offer through our bond proceeds for people who are buying foreclosed or vacant homes who need to have some money available for rehabilitation, so that we would provide the interim financing for, I think, 90 days, so that people can acquire the house, have some money to do the rehab, and then once it's rehabbed, they have the value there to refinance into a long-term loan, which we also have heard that will be very helpful. We have also made money available to for-profit developer on an interim financing basis to acquire properties in bulk, rehab them, and get them back on the market. That's been a little slower going than we had expected, but that money is still available, and we've helped them make connections with others that we think that will get off the ground soon. So that's what I can recall that we've done.
Mr. Chair, while you're catching your breath, the other question I had was, you have loans out, and you're receiving funds from those loans, payments back from those loans, if I understand. Can you give us an idea how much is out in loan money and what the annual payback is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kelash, we have a mortgage portfolio of $1.9 billion. It's about almost 20,000 loans. Wanted to know how much comes back in every month. I don't know that, but I can tell you that we have a AA+ bond rating, so we have enough money coming in to pay the bonds off. We have a delinquency rate, a foreclosure rate that's below the state average, the Bankers Association average.
Good. Thank you.
Just, Olson, last question. Here.
Okay.
We gotta get moving to comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Orr. Going back to where I was before, and I'm just wondering, in addition to cutting housing programs by 25%, the state's share, are there other monies that are tied to that money leverages? Are we losing any federal money or other money by making that cut?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, one of our budget principles was to try and preserve the programs that leverage other resources. So for the program that is most clearly and sort of consistently leveraging federal resources is the PARA program, and that program was held harmless under the proposed budget. I would argue that almost all of the programs leverage some resources from non-state resources. And the challenge program does have a component of leveraging non-state resources. And so to the extent that we cut back on the challenge program, that certainly there's a possibility that we will not we will miss some opportunities to leverage other non-state resources for housing.
Okay, and I think if you look on your budget book on page 56 and 57, it shows the non-state resources that are coming in to the agency. Good. Okay, any other, do you have any closing comments or do you have enough?
You're meeting on Wednesday.
Yeah, well, we're going to see you on Wednesday, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. We'll save any more questions for then. Thank you very much. Department of Commerce. Thank you for being patient, Commissioner. Congratulations on the Super Bowl win.
Thank you, Chairman Tomasoni and members of the committee for the opportunity to give a overview of the department and also an overview of the department from a budgetary standpoint.
Go ahead.
First, I would like to note that John Gross is here with me today. He's our health advisor, and he's not on the program, but I do like to acknowledge he and Pat Sexton as the two of the key advisors to the department. Two of the deputies will be testifying here in a few minutes. That's Deputy Commissioner Kevin Murphy and Deputy Commissioner Manny Munson-Regala. like to start off very quickly with the acknowledgement of something that now into my seventh year, I feel very comfortable in talking about the breadth and depth of the staff that we have at the department. They've been very helpful to me, and I think to the state. There's a tremendous amount of experience, and not only that, but one of the things that surprises me, it gives me also a great deal of confidence, is the fact that we have 63 people in the department, about 20% that have advanced degrees, in addition to considerable experience. And that's in engineering, actuaries, mathematicians, historians, just about all of the disciplines that we might need to be able to call on for being able to bring information to this committee and elsewhere. Something that that I feel very, very strongly about that I wanted to make sure that I mentioned to this committee has not much to do with the budget, but it sure, I think, affects the future of the state and the way we regulate. And that's the intrusion of the federal government into the regulatory scheme, particularly as it relates to insurance. The optional federal charter for the entire 6 years that I've been in the department has been a very much a concern to the department, and I think it's a greater threat today than it's ever been. And I think that the every committee that I have an opportunity to speak to, I like to make sure that they understand that the it's my opinion that there's no federal agency that operates as we do in terms of the consumers of this state. And I've been a part of a been regulated by the federal government. I've been in Ginnie Mae, and there's no department in government that responds to consumers the way our department responds to consumers. More than 100,000 a year, more than 25,000 are related specifically to insurance. And I know it's not necessarily a purview of this committee, but it is something that bothers me considerably. And just wanted to make note of that. In terms of full-time employees, we'll have information for you to how the department's broken down, but it's a very broad set of responsibilities. And so the department is shallow in a lot of areas, but very, very broad. The department has people that are seasoned in all these areas, which I feel comfortable in being able to meet public obligations and obligations to this committee with the information that is always in my time at the department has always been correct and something that I could depend on and rely on. The other thing that's probably important to the committee is, frankly, our total number of employees is about 30 less than it was 6 years ago, but we have installed 13 major systems to the department, which makes it significantly more efficient. One of these areas that we used to do all the continuing education tracking by hand, 200 and some thousand Minnesotans have license, require 10 to 15 hours a year each. For 20 different disciplines, and they can be those classes can be taken at 1,800 locations, 22,000 courses, and we were tracking it by hand. We were doing a bad job of it, but now it's all online, or most of it's online, so that that's an element of the efficiency, an example of how we have built in a considerable amount of efficiency into the department.
So your computers are working over there.
Pardon me?
Your computers are working in Commerce. Because we got some departments where the computers don't work very good, so I'm just making sure your computers are working there.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, they work well, but they need to be upgraded and reprogrammed often.
All right, okay.
I'd like to just mention, and I don't diminish the importance of our budget to the state one bit. In fact, we try to manage the income side of our department as much as we manage the expense side. But the truth is, when it comes down to the state budget, we're not even 1% of all other. But we have tried to manage the department in such a way as that today we're about 10% less than we were 6 years ago in terms of dollars. And our revenue that's generated by the department is up over $100 million. We've increased the revenue side in a significant way. With that, I know we'd like to move directly on to the budget. Our chief financial officer is here to go over that, Mr. Chairman. He's got 15 years with the state, a wide variety of departments, finance department immediately prior to joining the Commerce Department 3 years ago. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Tim Jakey, and he'll present the details of the budget.
Welcome, Mr. Jakey. Please say your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman. Tim Jakey, Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Commerce. I'm going to walk through a few slides here just to kind of give some kind of high-level overview of our budget. Just note that the slides that we were presenting here are still our base budget slides. We're working on updating those, but I will then walk through our change items, and we'll get you that updated
information.
Do we
have them? Do we have them here? Are you just going to go through the budget?
We can get you some slides here.
If you have a whole bunch of them. Otherwise, don't worry about it.
He's got a fistful in his hand.
Here, Nicole. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the first slide here that when you have them in front of you is basically our expenditures by program. This is at the program level. It's across all funds. And it shows basically trying to get a perspective on where the funding is. 80% of our funding is in the Office of Energy Security, which isn't under the purview of this committee. And we'll focus mainly on the items that are under the purview, but I think it's good to get this perspective. So about 80% of the budget is in the Office of Energy Security, and really it's in the federal funds. We have about $553 million a year is what we're planning to spend, a biennium, and $380 million of that is in the energy assistance program alone. That was slide six. I'm going to move on to slide seven. This slide is the expenditures by fund. And again, this is across all programs in the department. But you can really see that our federal funding is the bulk of our money. And that's the energy assistance and weatherization programs. In addition, we have a fairly large chunk of special revenue funds. And those are items that are in our market assurance area primarily, with some others. We have the insurance fraud prevention account, which is in that special revenue area. We have the auto theft prevention account, the telecommunications access Minnesota, the TAM account, and weights and measures. Those are the primary things that make up the 12%. The petrol fund, which is about 6%, it's a relatively small amount of operational money, just over $1 million a year, but it's near $15 million a year for reimbursements to landowners. And then we have two other small areas.
How is that fund doing?
Mr.
Chair. The petrol fund.
Doing well.
It's well capitalized?
Yeah.
Okay.
The workers' comp and agency fund are other two small areas. We'll get into the general fund as the deputies walk through their areas. We'll talk a little bit more about the general fund. The slide eight is our agency revenue. Just trying to get a perspective on the information the commissioner had shared with you. This revenue shows funding for the coming biennium. The left side of that pie chart shows our non-dedicated monies, petrol fund and the general fund. The general fund is about $213 million, and it's broken down. There's a box there in the lower left-hand corner that shows the major sources in the general fund. $69.5 million is for the unclaimed property program. That's net of the claims that are paid out to claimants. The securities registration, this is otherwise known as the mutual fund cap, is about $74 million. If you'll remember, that cap had been set at $25 million. It was moved to 25.6, and then last session it was removed. So there's additional funding in here based on that.
Whoa. So it was set at $25 million, and we collected $75
million? This is... Senator, this is biennial. This is biennial number. So we're up around, you know, $35 million in that neighborhood per year.
That's how much came in.
Correct.
Okay.
That's how much we're expecting to collect in the coming.
Okay.
Licensing area is about $25 million for the coming biennium, and then there's multiple other sources that I didn't want to have the laundry list on here, but those things include, financial institutions.
I know we have budget problems, but can you make these numbers bigger next time? I mean, in size, the font. Okay.
In financial institutions, the assessments are included in that $43 million, utility assessments, fines, penalties, and then also weights and measures inspection fees are in there. If you focus to the right side of the pie chart, there's about $470, almost $2 million in dedicated revenues. And again, those are primarily our federal funds. We're expecting to get over $407 million in the next biennium from the federal government, primarily in our energy assistance area. Move on to one additional slide here, slide 9. Kind of take a look at the agency revenue versus expenditures. The bottom portion here, the kind of the gray part of each of the bars, shows that we're expecting in the general fund to receive just over $200 million in revenue for the coming biennium, and our expenditures will be just right around $45 million. So you can see that Commerce receives a lot more money into the general fund than is spent. And you can look at that as well for all funds, which includes the white portion of the bar here as well. We're expecting about $687 million in revenue and about $553 million in expenditures.
Can you explain that just a little bit more? Now, are these fees that are being charged and then they're going into the general fund? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Well, Chairman, there's a number of the things. It's the assessments that we have on the industries and financial institution examinations. This includes our utility, regulated utility assessments, weights and measures, fees, the mutual fund money, all of that types of revenues that are going into the general fund is about $213 million, is that lower portion of the bar.
And the agency itself uses about 45?
Correct.
Chair.
It's Senator Dibble.
I think we have a little profit center here in Commerce.
Yeah, but this is all generated through things that you do, right? I mean, the money that goes into the general fund, is it used for other purposes or is it used for Commerce purposes?
Mr. Chair, it's put into the general fund, and that's the legislative process uses that. It could go for a number of things. It's not sitting there waiting for us.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. President, I want to hear a little bit more about this from those who are paying those fees.
That's probably a good idea. Senator Dibble, repeat your question because they're...
I'm surprised we don't hear more from the folks who are paying those fees about how much is being charged and where exactly that's being spent. As I understand, I thought actually we had a statutory constraint from charging more than we actually need for a direct fee for services. Is that true? I know we certainly talk about that a lot when we're discussing local units of government and the fees they charge. We're pretty strict with them about how much they're able to charge for licensing fees and other kinds of services, so they're not generating profits to their general fund. Does state government have a similar constraint?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, yes. There are guidelines that the Department of, MMB, the old Department of Finance, has. As far as we put together departmental earnings information every year that's presented through MMB to the legislature, and you know, in theory, yes, we're just supposed to basically recover our costs.
And Senator Dibble, this is how we've been balancing our budget for a number of years now.
I recall this discussion in 2003.
And some of us don't think that it might be exactly the right way to do it, but it's been going on since 2003, at least, that I know of. So anyway, go ahead.
Those are kind of the basic overview of the information. I'll move into the change items. We have on slide 10 here, there's two change items that are under the purview of this committee in the market assurance area. We have a proposal for cost recovery in the market assurance area for investigative work. Currently, the work is being done. Companies being investigated are paying for it. We have outside contractors who are doing the work, and it's basically a pass-through. What this proposal entails is we'll hire some additional staff, do the work in-house. We'll charge the companies less, and beyond that, we'll net about $74,000 to the general fund to help offset the budget deficit. We'll increase our expenditures by about $680,000, increase revenue about $754,000. We'll take a decrease in the workers' comp fund of about $84,000, which is a 10% reduction in that fund, and then have a small increase in our special revenue fund expenditures to offset some of the reductions.
Are you guys going to get my auto glass stuff taken care of up north?
Mr. Chair, when Deputy Commissioner Munson Regala is up, you can ask him about that.
Okay, all right.
The second item is product review and registration changes. Currently, companies file and wait for our response, and then they can begin selling insurance products in the state or securities products. What this will do is take a certain portion of the of those filings and make them file in use. So upon file, the companies begin selling those, and then we reserve the right to go back and audit those. This would be about a $300,000 decrease to the general fund, and it would be about a 4 FTE reduction.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just have to say I don't think that's a very good idea. I mean, I just seems to me that then no one's looking at the product before it's being offered to consumers. And when we talk about consumer protection, not having done that review up front and looking at page 10, you know, where you're giving a little more detail about this and you're saying you're moving from a front-end review to a back-end review, I think you're just opening the door wide open for the potential for more consumer problems, more potential fraud, more bad types of products that maybe don't meet all of our regulations. And in an era where we've seen very clearly what deregulation has caused with the banking industry, turning around and having less oversight of the insurance industry, I just think that's a really bad idea.
Okay. You want to comment?
Mr. Chair, I'm Deputy Commissioner Manny Munson-Regala of the Market Assurance Division, where the rate and form filings go through. If I may respond to Senator Olson.
Please.
Senator Olson, we're obviously facing tough decisions to make, so we had to look through our division about where we had potential capacity that we could move to areas where we're going to know we're going to have additional need. We looked at our rate filing area, rate and form filing area in particular, because over the last 5 years, we've had a decrease in the number of filings we've received from companies. We also looked at the number of filings we received where we actually objected to some provision of the filing. In other words, where there was a provision or an element by the company where there was a problem, they were not compliant with the statutory provision. Lastly, there are a number of lines that under current law are already filed in use, predominantly in the workers' compensation area. Having said that, we opted to keep a number of policy areas still subject to prior approval, including workers' compensation, annuities, and most of the health insurance products. Those are the lines of insurance where we are continuing to see some confusion in the marketplace with what Minnesota requires. Part of our proposal also will require us to do back-end audits for the products that companies are currently putting in the marketplace under the file and use regimen. So we'll see what they're actually selling to see if what they're actually selling is compliant with Minnesota law. That dovetails with the first part of our change item, which is the cost of doing those back-end reviews will be assessed back to the company. So we'll be able to recover the cost of looking at what they're doing.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Senator Olson. I think this is moving in the exact opposite direction of where we need to move in terms of making sure that insurance is providing the kind of service and the kind of coverage and the kind of protection, market protection that consumers need. I think the reason we probably haven't had some of the problems that were discussed is because, you know, the opportunity to review ahead of time. I think going back after the horse has left the barn is a lot more difficult. I mean, especially now with insurance companies trying to recover through rates or trying to recover through parsing down risk or, you know decreasing coverage or, raising sanctions for experience, et cetera. I'm sure the insurance companies are doing backflips over this proposal. This is not good for consumers.
Well, we've certainly seen over the last few years that if you let people go unregulated, they definitely take advantage of it. In this whole scheme here, what you're basically doing is just taking less of the general fund money than you used to take, so the governor can use it to balance the budget, and so you're cutting some of the things like regulating these insurance products in order to comply with that, even though you put $600 million into the general fund that doesn't come back to the agency. But anyway, I think that's my question.
Mr. Chair, I think absent the budget needs, I think I would have been recommending some internal resource allocation given the number of filings that we're currently receiving compared to 5 years ago, roughly a 1,000 count decrease. Given the likelihood that the state interstate insurance compact gets upline and gets more life insurance products vetted through the compact process, we're going to see fewer filings. My sense is that I'm going to have some filing folks with not much to do. Part of our solution was to find ways to find out to keep the folks who are currently doing quite a bit engaged in the process and to make some decisions about where we had some excess capacity.
Senator Olson.
Well, I don't understand that, how that makes any sense. It seems to me like if you have fewer filings, then all the more reason why you should be able to review those filings on the front end instead of just foregoing that and just auditing them on the back end. It's not like you can't move people around or you have to keep people locked into this position if you're not using them. I know that there is a lot of need within Commerce, for example, to be dealing with all the mortgage foreclosure investigations, because I know that some of those investigations have been delayed for a couple of years, and I thought it was a resource problem. So, again, if you are having fewer filings, to me, all the more reasons why you ought to be able to look at them on the front end.
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, the folks that I'm going to have left are going to be pretty busy doing what is going to be left on their plate. Can we do more? I suppose we can. That's asking quite a bit of my folks, but we'll do the best we can.
Well, we don't want you to fire anybody. That's the deal here, see. We want you to keep using them.
Well, I understand, Mr. Chair, part of our proposal would be to increase the folks that do investigations who are going to have to fully fund themselves. So the folks that I'm going to lay off on the product side will have an opportunity on the investigation side to stay with Commerce.
Are these my Autoglass guys you're laying off?
I would assume, Senator, Mr. Chair, that we're going to have capacity to do more Autoglass claims as a result of our proposal.
Any further questions? Are you done yet?
No, Mr. Chair. We have just a couple more here.
Okay.
On slide 11, There's two change items. We'll skip over the first one. It's for Office of Energy Security. We'll move to the second one for Administrative Services. This reduction is approximately a $411,000 reduction to our general fund budget. If fully implemented, this would be about a 6.5 FTE reduction in our admin area. It would what our proposal is to move three of those individuals to our indirect cost account. This is an account that we're able to set aside funds from our federal funds to pay for internal work that's done. What we're going to do is fund three of those positions out of that account. That account is going to see an increase. It has already seen an increase because of the additional federal funds that we're receiving this year, and we're expecting that it will have that will be ongoing for the next few years because of the increased money that we're getting from energy assistance funding at the federal level. The additional, we'd have about a 3.5 FTE reduction in our other support areas within the admin division, one FTE reduction in our human resources office, and a couple, about 2.5 in the other general support areas. And we haven't specifically identified those positions yet, and we're trying to create some efficiencies and have some cost-saving measures that would not require us to lay those folks off. But those areas could be affected would be our mail room, general support, our front desk, those types of areas.
Does the governor's the agency overview on page 6 of the budget book, it looks like from 09 to 11, there's only going to be 4 full-time equivalent reduced. And it sounds like, just in the last 2, you've done 6.5. Do they not match up, or there's something here that's not consistent, or?
Mr. Chair, I don't have it in front of me here. I'll look into that, and if I can just get back to Mr. Jensen with that information.
Okay. Yeah, it's a two-person difference, but I see it's different. So I'm just wondering if we're talking about the same thing or not, or maybe it's how you call an FTEs. I don't know, but at any rate, let's get an answer on that eventually. Okay.
Yep. No problem. Mr. Chair, and then the last slide here is the FY09 unallotment. We had a target of $500,000 for the Department of Commerce as a whole. The first item here is for energy security. We just skip past that. The second one is for market assurance. We had some uncommitted carry forward from the last year, $110,000. We hadn't committed those monies because we kind of saw the problems coming in 9 and did want to have some flexibility. So the 110 is from market assurance, and then 140,000 is from the administrative services area. The moving the three positions to the indirect cost account, we'll just do that in fiscal 9 and be able to cancel 140 back to the general fund. So you can see half of the reductions here were taken in the areas under the purview of this committee, and then the other half was in the energy area. And that's all I had on the budget overview slides. If there's questions.
Any questions on general fund?
Mr.
Senator Dibble?
I was just looking at the change on the moving the three folks to the indirect cost and just some of the services that might not be available, asking answering employees' questions about their benefits, a new employee orientation. Isn't that stuff that admin can provide and just refer them over? Can't they carry some of those back of house administrative services? Maybe they don't, but this seems like something that admin should be able to do for the other agencies.
Chairman and Senator Dibble, that information is available online. I mean, it's basically the employees have access to that information via website, our website internally, as well as website provided by MMB or admin. So that the information, it's not that it won't be available to them. It's that they you know, we won't have a half-day session with new employees to kind of spoon-feed them all of the policies and procedures. We'll ask that they go look at those, and we'll still require that they sign the appropriate policies for all the types of stuff. And as well as for benefits, that information is available through MMB's website, et cetera. So it's not that the employees won't have it. It's just that we're not going to be kind of working with them as much as we did in the past.
Yeah, the new doer budget.
Okay.
Yeah, they should be able to do all that stuff for agencies. Right. That's an alignment. I'm always surprised when I find out different agencies are all doing their own thing.
Well, every time we talk about this stuff, we find out agencies don't communicate. And every year we keep thinking we're getting better and better at communicating between agencies, but I don't know.
Here's an opportunity. This is a good one. I like this.
Okay. Mr. Munson-Ragala, are you next?
I am, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you. Manny Munson-Ragala, Deputy Commissioner for the Market Assurance Division. Quick note about my background. I've been an insurance regulatory compliance government affairs lawyer for the past 22 years. Before coming to Commerce roughly a year ago, Market Assurance is the arm of the department that handles consumer complaints, enforcement, and licensing matters, including glass claims. The first slide you have on page 15 is the base year expenditures. Shows you how we spend the money we get from different sources. Next slide, page 16, shows you our expenditures by fund. Roughly a third of our money comes from general. As I mentioned, Market Assurance enforces compliance and responsible business conduct across a broad range of licensed occupations. By last count, roughly 18 or so of the industries we regulate come through Market Assurance. We provide assistance to consumers. We view the insurance products and register securities sold in Minnesota. And we license the business and individuals in a number of different areas. The commissioner talked about our licensing. We license over 200,000 individuals a year. About 105,000 of them are insurance producers. That's roughly an increase of 25,000 insurance producers in the last 2 years. You might find this interesting that the ratio of resident to non-resident licensees has changed in the last 5 years from 45 resident to non-resident to now a 43-57 split. We have more non-resident producers doing business in Minnesota than we used to have. We also license.
Are they paying that fee, that securities fee? Is that part of that security? Is that part of that securities fee that we're collecting, or is that going to do with it?
No, they're just paying a non-resident producer license.
Okay.
We license about 27,000 real estate brokers agents. As the commissioner mentioned, we look at about 850 approved education sponsors and approximately 22,000 approved courses. And the bulk of our work is done electronically, which I suspect has a lot to do with the fact that we have had a dramatic increase in the number of licensees. It's much easier to get licensed here than it used to be. With respect to consumer assistance.
But doesn't the insurance company have to want to hire you in order for you to actually get a license?
That would be a good idea, but I suspect some folks get a license in the hopes of getting appointments with different insurance companies. They might not necessarily have an appointment lined up. A number of our insurance producers aren't employees of any particular company, but represent a number. Those are the so-called independent agents.
Independent agents, yeah.
We also answer roughly 25,000 in consumer calls in fiscal year 08. About 19,000 of them were insurance related. The rest of them were miscellaneous real estate, collection agencies, do not call, cigarette pricing, I guess. In addition to the consumer calls we took, we opened 6,700 formal investigative files, and we finally provide on-site assistance after storms. The pictures on the slide are from our folks out in the Hugo neighborhoods after those tornadoes visiting with policyholders.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, Deputy Commissioner, if there's a breakdown available of the type of complaints you get that we could take a look at. I'd really be interested to see that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I do believe we have a breakout. We'll get that to the committee. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, just to clarify, I think we do it by industry type. I don't think we get down to the level of within insurance complaints, what the nature of the insurance complaints are. I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we do have that information. We'll try to get that to you.
Okay.
The next slide on page 20.
It's got to be on one of your computers.
It's a good thing that we have computers. The next slide, Mr. Chair, members, on page 20 talks about the recoveries. Recoveries reflect the amount we get for consumers above and beyond the amount initially offered to them by the companies we regulate. So if an insurance company offers $1,000, we intervene, the final payout is $2,000, we count $1,000 as part of our recoveries. The recoveries also reflect money we get for consumers as a result of market conduct actions we take or class action settlements that we are parties to, which would explain the two big spikes in 2003-2005. In addition to the recoveries that are on this chart, our fraud folks wanted to make sure you guys knew that as part of their criminal investigations, they will get, as part of the sentencing agreements, restitution for victims. In 2007, our criminal cases generated about $3.06 million in restitution for victims, and in 2008, we generated $2.6 million in restitution. Next slide on page 21 shows you the number of enforcement files that we have engaged in over the last 6 years. The one thing I would note about our enforcement, Senator Olson had the opportunity to hear this in the Commerce Committee, the work of market assurance has evolved over the last several years from being primarily a civil disciplinary organization to becoming almost a white-collar criminal unit. We used to refer for criminal prosecution on the average of 2 to 3 cases a year. We have, at this time, 70 open files where criminal authorities are involved. We average one file a week reported to us with some allegation of criminal misconduct. For my real estate team, for example, has roughly the same number of open files, 1,600, but about 300 of them involve some allegation of mortgage fraud. So that's been the biggest change in market assurance over the last 2-3 years, is the nature of the work we're doing. We still handle consumer complaints, but now when we get a consumer complaint, it doesn't take very long before we start digging and we find out that the misconduct involves not just potential fine or censure, but possible referral to a criminal authority. The next slide talks about the focus of our market conduct. That is the primary activity that's covered by our first change item. That is the cost recovery change item we shared with you. Market conduct exams are the exams we take off primarily of insurance companies, though we do look at other industries like collection agencies. Our exams tend to now have more of a multi-state nature. We work with other states because of the nature of the allegations we're looking at transcend our borders. They tend to be business practices by companies that go across other states. So we find that having the leverage of having a few fellow states joining in with us gets the company's attention. We're also making sure that all of our market conduct efforts include some fairly robust remediation efforts. For example, we may settle a market conduct exam with a sizable monetary penalty. We will agree to defer some portion of the monetary penalty as long as the company performs along a pre-agreed corrective action plan or remediation plan. The one last note I would share about market conduct exams is that since the commissioner has come to Commerce, we've actually suspended the ability of 4 companies to take to do business in our state. My sense from talking to our staff is that's a relatively new process. Before, we would collect a penalty, but then the company could continue doing business. Now, not only do we collect penalties, but we also say, before you can come back and do business in our state, you have to wait at least 5 years and show that you've cleaned up your act or taken other steps to ensure good behavior.
Can we ask who they were?
One was Physicians. I'll get you the 4 companies.
Okay. You know, the recovery slide is interesting to me. I think you mentioned why there were the two big spikes, but why was the last year so low?
Part of that, I suspect, Mr. Chair, is that My consumer team, my consumer response team, has done a fairly good job of educating companies what the heck we expect. So there are less opportunities for misunderstanding with companies as to how we interpret our claim handling laws. But I have my director of investigations and consumer outreach. He might be able to share a little bit more about that.
Okay. Well, we can do that. If you go ahead, if you want to. Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of interesting. But now, tell me about my Autoglass, because we've been trying to get this thing straightened out for about 5 years, and it's not about choice in the market, and it's not about people paying opting for one company or another because they can. It's about the region that we're in, and we've been doing this now for 5 years, and we can't get you guys to do anything, which makes me think that maybe that's the division we should cut the 3.5 people out of if we have to, in order if you're not going to go and do this. So I mean, somewhere along the way, you guys got to tell me why we haven't got this done yet.
Sure, Mr. Chair. In general, my sense from talking to our folks is they get a complaint, they look into it. If there's a violation, they're not hesitant about acting upon any violations. Now, with that as sort of general framework, what I'd like to do is have our Director of Investigations and Consumer Outreach, Robert Commodore, take you through what happens in the Autoglass investigation.
All right, here's what we're going to do. As long as I got you at the table, that's really good. Let's do this in my office, okay? And so, Kat, make an appointment with these guys, because I want to have a real good discussion on this, and that maybe the committee structure isn't exactly the right place because we're running out of time here. But if I have to have you back into the committee, we can do that. But for now, let's get an appointment up in the office, and let's try and get this straightened out so we can all be comfortable about it. And are there any more questions? Okay, let's move on then to Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Kevin Murphy, Deputy Commissioner of the Financial Institutions Division. I've been at the Commerce Department for about 10 years. My previous experience includes many years as
Mr. Murphy, can you bring the microphone a little bit closer to you?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I've been at the Commerce Department for about 10 years. My previous experience includes 17 years with the FDIC as a federal bank regulator and 12 years in the private sector doing consulting work. Our slides started around number 30, and basically we license and regulate and look after the solvency of banks, credit unions, finance companies, and insurance companies. We also license mortgage companies, check cashers, payday lenders, and money transmitters. And we have kind of two major goals in our world. One is we want a competitive market for financial services with lots of choices for Minnesota citizens. On the other side, we want to minimize failures of financial institutions, which are a bad thing for our consumers. So the two goals are kind of inherently conflicting, and we have to kind of strike the balance between those two. Some of the high spots over the last several years: we've licensed 150 new insurance companies to operate in Minnesota. In the last couple of years, we've approved 21 new state bank charters since 2003. We've not had any failures of state banks, credit unions.
Excuse me, Mr. Murphy. Senator Olson.
Thank you. I'm with regard to, I've heard it mentioned a couple times now, Mr. Murphy, that we have had a big increase in the number of insurance companies doing business here from outside the area. And I'm wondering whether, you know, if you can tell me what area of insurance, if they're focused primarily in a particular type of insurance offering. And I'm particularly interested in knowing if there's a large number of them are offering the high deductible health insurance plans. Is that where we're seeing the big increase coming from, or is it in another area?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, maybe if you'd take a look at slide number 37, which is a little bit back further.
I don't have a 37.
We go to 33.
I'm sorry. That's the insurance companies break down into two big categories: the life and health companies, And the it's one big category, and the property casualty companies are another category, and that's homeowner insurance, car insurance, and the like. We have about 32 Minnesota life and health companies that we license.
You meant 32. See, your eyes are just as bad as mine.
Did you mean, no, 32 companies. He's
But did you mean slide 32 and not 37?
You guys have a different slide than Kevin does. He's working off of a set of slides he's set up for the House, which is a lot more in-depth than what you guys have.
And I'll get you why both. Is that?
Because we were going to be quick.
We have about 80 Minnesota companies that we directly regulate, 32 life and health, 47 property and casualty. We have 454 out-of-state life and health companies that operate in Minnesota, and we have about 800 property casualty companies that operate in Minnesota. And I think most of the increase is in the property casualty companies that offer car insurance and homeowner insurance in Minnesota. And, of course, the insurance is very, very complex, and a lot of companies in specific niches. So literally hundreds of companies.
So, Mr. Chair, then we didn't scare them away with our bad faith legislation, it looks like.
I guess they're still here.
I guess the short answer is I don't think we've seen dozens of new companies in the category that you asked about.
Okay.
We've had no failures of state banks, credit unions, or insurance companies in recent history. We've started an exam program for mortgage companies, which began in 2008, which is just getting off the ground. And in the insurance regulation world, we're the nationwide leader in risk-focused examination of insurance companies, which it's much more meaningful than it used to be. It used to be that insurance regulation merely duplicated what the accounting firms did, a lot of bean counting, but now it's much more risk-focused and a lot more scoping that goes on. So Minnesota's in the forefront in that arena. And as far as our expenditures, we spend about almost $10 million a year. We have about 67 FTE people. Our division is a little bit unique in the state government. Basically, we collect back from the regulated industries all of the money that you appropriate for us. And I hope that you have the slide that shows expenditures by funds in there. We have, as far as the general fund, about $6.6 million, which is basically covers our commerce staffing.
Members, this is on page 15 in the budget book, if you want to take a look at that.
I think that should be on slide 29, and I apologize for the confusion here. The general fund money is basically to fund our staff. The special revenue fund, $3.2 million per year. For the bigger insurance companies, we contract out the examinations to accounting and consulting firms, and there's several reasons for that. One is that the exam cycle for insurance companies is like a 5-year cycle for most companies, a 3-year cycle for health companies and HMOs. And to staff at the level to handle all that work would be very, very expensive, and the workload is very uneven. And I guess the other big reason is that the insurance companies are like the biggest life insurance company is like $80 billion in Minnesota in assets. And for us to send in examiners that make $50,000 or $60,000 a year and expect them to come back with some meaningful work results would not be productive.
Is that $80 billion domiciled in Minnesota? Is that what you mean, or just the biggest company in Minnesota?
That's the I think the one biggest company, the River Source companies, which were spun off from American Express, their total assets are $80 billion.
But they're not domiciled.
They are domiciled here.
Okay.
So as far as breaking down our expenditures, we spend about half of it on insurance regulation and the other half on the bank and credit union side. And that's in slide 29, a little bit of an overview of the kind of companies that we regulate and license. We have 323 banks, 96 credit union, 183 consumer credit companies. That would include also the payday lenders. We license 1,200 mortgage companies. We also license some currency exchangers. These are the check cashing places that you see in some neighborhoods. Also 68 money transmitters. Those are companies that send money to Mexico and the parts of Africa. What we're seeing currently, most of the state bank and credit unions are healthy, but we're seeing some pretty marked deterioration in bank and credit union loan portfolios. We've been on several articles in the news media lately about, well, of course, the New York banks are having their troubles, but that's also seeing some, or it's having some effect in Minnesota. For example, we have 50 Minnesota state banks on our what we call our watch list. We have a rating system for banks. We rate banks from 1 to 5. One is the best, 2 is good, 3 is fair, 4 and 5 are less than satisfactory. So the watch list includes the 3, 4, and 5 rated banks. And so we have 50, which is about 15% of all the state banks, and that's double from 26, 18 months ago. So the number of banks with issues are climbing. 22 of those 50 are in the Twin Cities metro area. 27 are outstate. Having so many metro area banks on our watch list is a relatively new development. For the first three quarters of 08, 16% of the state banks recorded losses, which is pretty hefty. The year-end data are not in yet, but I would guess that it would be even higher than that. We're seeing similar difficulties in credit unions. We have 9 credit unions on our watch list. That's about 10% of the total, 4 in the metro and 5 outstate. One credit union recently went through a shotgun wedding with a larger, more healthy credit union. We'll talk a little bit about the safety net for depository institutions. That would be both banks and credit unions.
Is a shotgun wedding in the credit industry a good thing?
It's a good thing for the members of the credit union. Okay. It's probably a bad thing for the credit union that was forced to merge.
Okay. All right, now it makes sense.
Pardon me?
Now it makes sense to me.
For depositories, bank and credit union deposits are both insured by federal agencies up to $250,000 per customer, and that's been raised recently by the feds, and it's scheduled to go back to the $100,000 at year end, whether or not it's still kind of up for grabs. Most consumers are not at risk. We did have one federally chartered bank fail in Minnesota early in 2008. That was a smaller bank in Staples, Minnesota, and that was taken over by the FDIC and immediately merged into a larger North Dakota bank. Seamless transaction with no loss to consumers. When I worked for the FDIC, part of my job was to arrange mergers of failing banks, so I know my way around that arena fairly well. Nationwide, there were 28 bank failures in 08, and I think we've had 6 so far this year. A little bit about the insurance regulation side. In the banking world, we have partnerships with our federal counterparts. We take turns on examinations, and there's quite a sharing of effort in that. In the insurance side, there is no federal regulator of insurance. It's the 50 states are responsible for insurance regulation. We also participated in the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is a mechanism for exchanging information and also for developing model laws for states to adopt. Minnesota is primarily responsible for regulating and assuring the solvency of the 79 Minnesota companies that are physically present here. Some of the big names in the life and health arena are Allianz, Minnesota Life, and ReliaStar, all very big companies on the property and casualty side. St. Paul Fire and Marine is a great big company, also Federated Mutual in Owatonna. We conduct periodic on-site exams of these companies, generally on a 5-year cycle, but we can do it more often if need be. Like I said before, we farm out the exams of the bigger insurance companies to accounting and consulting firms, and they do the work to our specifications and under our guidance with pretty healthy oversight from our people. We also monitor the quarterly financials submitted by both Minnesota companies and also out-of-state companies that are licensed to operate here. For example, Northwestern Mutual, a Wisconsin company, is licensed to operate in Minnesota, and we keep an eye on those, but Wisconsin would be primarily responsible for the frontline regulation of that company. We have a watch list for insurance companies, and we accord those on the list additional scrutiny. Currently, we have a dozen Minnesota companies on our watch list, which is about 15%, mostly small companies, and none of those in what I would call the danger zone. As far as the safety net for insurance consumers, we have two guarantee funds that are overseen by the Commerce Department, one for life and health companies and a separate one for property and casualty insurance companies. And these are both a little bit like the federal FDIC for bank deposits, but they're not prepaid, where the FDIC has a barrel of money that they've already collected. The guarantee funds pass the hat among the licensed companies when we have a need for them to bail out an insurance company.
Deputy Commissioner, just a quick question. I have a constituent that called me about a disability insurance policy that she had that was issued by a Wisconsin company, and they refused to pay even though she's collecting disability under all the definitions of disability. Would this be something we should contact your department on, or is this something that we would go through Wisconsin on, or would it be a combination of both? Or
Mr. Chairman, that would be in Deputy Commissioner Manny Munson's area, but certainly your constituent could contact our department.
You don't have to answer. No, I'll be in touch, though, okay, as long as you're coming over anyway.
I was talking about the guarantee funds that back up insurance companies. And in the life and health arena, currently consumers have the level of protection of insurance policy cash values is currently $130,000, and for insurance death benefits and annuity contracts in the payout stage, the coverage is up to $410,000, and I believe we might be the only state that has an inflation escalation provision in those coverages. So our consumers are covered to a higher degree than those in most other states. As far as how the industry is doing, the property and casualty companies are generally doing okay, and they're profitable, and that would be the retail, auto, and homeowner coverage, which are generally stable and predictable. They're subject to some weather-related losses, hail and hurricanes and things like that. Of course, unemployment and foreclosures and arsons are factors for those companies. Workers' compensation insurance, they suffer more fraud losses when the economy turns down like we're experiencing. Business insurance is fairly risky, and it's more volatile. As far as the life and health companies, it's a little bit harder to generalize. The companies in the straight life insurance business are doing fairly well. It's a generally stable kind of a business and fairly predictable. There are some issues with health companies and, you know, some of the increasing medical costs. We are a little bit concerned about some of the annuity providers, especially those that provided variable annuities where the level of benefits is linked to stock market performance. And many of these annuity contracts have built-in interest rate guarantees. And over the last several years, the companies have sold a lot of these, and the money that they take in premiums, they've invested in the stock market, which has gotten killed in the last couple of years. And a lot of these contracts have built-in interest rate crediting rates, so the companies are on the hook for the interest rate guarantees. In the meantime, the money they've invested in on the asset side has gone down, so there is some pressure on those companies. We're keeping an eye on that. There was some in the news media recently, the industry was pressuring the National Association of Insurance Commissioners to liberalize reserve requirements for life insurance companies, partly in response to the annuity issues. Some of those ideas have had merit, but generally the NAIC has turned down those efforts, and they'll be considered more in the ordinary course of business rather than be rammed through and as part of the financial crisis. That was all I had for prepared remarks, okay. Mr. Chairman.
And I think it looks like you're not getting any kind of a cut from the governor's recommendation from 09 to 10 and 11. An increase in FTEs by about 1.4, it looks. Does that sound about right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And what kind of – do you have – ability within the department to move people around if you need to, or are your experts in one area confined to that area, or how is it that just by design, or do you have the flexibility if you wanted to move them around?
Mr. Chairman, we have two big pieces to my department. One is the insurance side, which is mostly farmed out because it's so technical and complex, and we need more talent than we can afford. We just have small number of examiners in that side. On the bank and credit union side, we hire examiners, and the training is very similar. We can move people within banks and credit unions and finance companies after they have a certain level of experience. But generally, it takes a fair amount of training and expense to develop somebody so that they're proficient.
So Commissioner Wilson move somebody from your department over to workers' comp, for example, or is that generally not done?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that would be very effective. They are sort of specific lines of work. And, they would involve a fair amount of retraining almost.
Yeah, but he has that ability to do it in case there's this one special individual that can do both. Right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, you can just shake your head back there if you want, but...
Pat Saxon from the department. Yeah, and you can set up individual interdepartment agreements for usually a set period of time if there's a specific need. Does that answer your question?
No. Kind of a pretty general answer. I just want to know if you can move people around in the Commerce Department from one section to another if you need to because of the – I mean, you're going to be cutting people in some places, and it looks like this place you're going to be hiring some people. And so if the need is there and – obviously, the person would have to have the qualifications you need, but I would assume that there's some people in the Commerce Department that have a couple of specialties.
If they're not too specialized, yes, we can move them, but there are some limitations.
Okay. All right. Anybody have any further questions? Okay. We probably over the next few months will be in touch and maybe have you back a couple times depending upon what goes on with different bills and recommendations from different areas of the budget. So I appreciate your time and thank you for being patient. And what, wait, Cap?
We're not The committee will not be meeting on Wednesday, although the housing subcommittee will be meeting from 2 to 4 in room 318.
Okay. All right. Then thank you all, and meeting adjourned.